on the snowy and maybe icy day, wherever you're phoning from. And I'm going to have the marshal call the case, please.
Minnesota Court of Appeals is now in session. Judge Riley, Judge Flory, Judge Klopaki, the Honorable Denise D. Riley presiding. The first case this morning is A21-0719, Aspenwood Condominium of Duluth versus PMA Companies, member of the Old Republic Insurance Group.
Good morning and welcome to the Court of Appeals. We will be conducting the Zoom hearing as though we were in person. You'll each have 15 minutes with 5 minutes of rebuttal for appellant if you choose to use that. It is being recorded and will be posted on the court's website shortly. And when you begin your arguments, please state your name for the record. And with that, is counsel for the appellant ready to begin?
Yes, Your Honor.
You may proceed.
Good morning, Your Honors, and may it please the court. My name is John Whitmer, and I represent Appellant Aspenwood Condominium of Duluth Incorporated, a Minnesota nonprofit common interest community. This case arises from damage caused to Aspenwood's property by a wind and hailstorm on August 31st, 2018. At the time, Aspenwood was insured under a policy issued by respondent PMA Companies, a foreign insurance company, that provided coverage for, amongst other things, wind, fire, and hail. That policy contains language that no one may bring a legal action against the insurer unless that action is brought within 2 years after the date on which the direct physical loss or damage occurred. Within that two-year time period, on August 31st, 2020, Aspenwood attempted personal service at PMA's address at 380 Century Parkway, Bluebell, Pennsylvania.
Can I ask a quick question?
Yes,
you didn't on that same date, you didn't send a certified mail to the Commissioner of Commerce, did you?
We did not, Your Honor.
You waited another couple days.
One additional day, Your Honor.
One additional day. There was nothing to keep you from doing it the earlier time, was there?
Well, Your Honor, we would argue that there was something keeping us from doing it. First, it's not required that you use that permissive process to serve through the Commissioner of Commerce.
No, and I'm simply responding as I read your brief. You're arguing for us to make some kind of exception here and some kind of exception here, and claiming that you're sort of disadvantaged. But my question is directed to how were you disadvantaged when you could have done it if you just did it a day earlier and did it to the commissioner?
We could have served the Commissioner of Commerce on the 31st. What we opted to do was what we had the option to do was personal service at the Bluebell location. And the reason that we did that, Your Honor, was specifically with the intent to conserve judicial resources.
So but you did that without knowing whether anybody would be at the other end of that service.
Well, the assumption that someone would be at the end of that service was a presumption upon which the contract was based. So at the time the contract was entered into, the address in Pennsylvania was provided on the contract. It is also the registered address, and this is undisputed, with the state of Pennsylvania.
Mr. Whitmer, to your point that you were trying to conserve judicial resources, you didn't raise that with the district court. That was not one of your arguments, right?
It was not one of our arguments at the district court, Your Honor.
And so then, how do we review that on appeal if it wasn't raised below?
And so the Court of Appeals under the Minnesota Rule of Appellate Procedure 103.04 does allow that the court may review any matter in the interest as justice requires. That argument that it would have been impossible to serve does meet the factors that were established in Watson. That the issue presents a novel legal issue of first impression, that the issue was prominently raised in the briefings as it was in this case, that the issue was implicit in or closely akin to our arguments.
Let me stop you on that point, Mr. Whitmer. The only issues raised before the district court were the equitable issues. The district court judge's order says the parties acknowledge that service was not timely made. If the only issues before the district court was whether or not your equitable remedies applied, how is this issue implicit in or included in what was raised before the district court, your you're losing me on that part of your argument.
And although that wasn't raised directly at the district court, the issue was raised that performance became impractical at the district court in general. And so this is a version of that impracticability argument. And although that impracticability argument wasn't raised directly, a party is not precluded from making new arguments on appeal for a proposition that was raised at trial. And so this is directly related to that impracticability, even though it is a new argument based on that impracticability argument.
How is it impractical if all you had to do is put a stamp on a letter and send it to the Commissioner of Commerce?
Well, first, that stamp on the letter is a permissive process.
I know it's permissive, but it's allowable. You waited till the very last day of the period at 3 o'clock in the afternoon. It seems to me there was some huge red flags about whether or not service was going to be appropriately accomplished here. And I'm just wondering, with that remedy obviously available under the statute to serve a foreign corporation, how it was impractical for you not to do that.
Because of the burden that process of service creates, which is that as soon as you serve through the Commissioner of Commerce, within 21 days, you do have to file the case with the Minnesota District Court so that you can serve the accompanying affidavit with that filing. That burden takes away the ability for the parties to conserve the judicial resources and navigate through the process as we intended. And because it's not a required process that you do serve through substitute service, our option was to, at that point, conserve the judicial resources and try to navigate without extended litigation in the courts.
So we're reviewing that on an abuse of discretion standard. How did the district court judge abuse his discretion by finding that you could have easily accomplished service at the last minute? That's a tough argument for you, in my opinion, to show an abuse of discretion under those circumstances.
Because what the district court essentially did, Your Honor, was require us to attempt multiple methods of service of process at the same time.
He didn't say anything about that. I mean, he didn't require you to do that. That's what you could have done.
And that's not directly in his order. He didn't say that we were required to do, but that's the practical effect, Your Honor. Because we did use the permissive option to serve through personal service as our preferred method, the only way that we would have on that last date been able to serve through the Commissioner of Commerce is if we would have been required to do both, Your Honor.
Well, weren't you assuming some risk by not doing both when you were attempting to initiate this suit at the last minute?
No, Your Honor, that as far as assumption of the risk, we had the absolute belief as required under the policy or as provided under the policy that the insurance company's doors would be open at that Pennsylvania address. Additionally, the Pennsylvania statute does require the insurance company to maintain a registered address. And so we did, based on those two principles, believe that we would be able to accomplish service.
Thank you.
And to some extent, we have now gone into some of the equitable issues that we did raise at the district court. And as far as those equitable issues, there are really one main reason that specifically equitable tolling should be granted in this case, is that Aspenwood had no ability, no control over the fact that those doors were closed. That was a unilateral decision made by PMA companies. And based on that unilateral decision, Aspenwood was impossible for Aspenwood to accomplish personal service. And I don't think there's any dispute about that.
Mr. Whitmer, you knew that you were shaving it really close. The inspector got on top of the roof on August 16th, right? And you knew at that point that you had, about 2 weeks to file a complaint or get this thing in process. And you waited till the last day. It wasn't a hard complaint to draft up. Waited to the last day to try to get that served. And you did it through personal service. when the other route to mail it to the commissioner was also available.
Yes, Your Honor. Personal service.
And just, I'm trying to figure out where the equity is in that.
That, again, Your Honor, that there are burdens with substitute service through the commissioner that specifically the Aspenwood did not want to encounter.
And but which you did not raise to the district court. And frankly, they don't seem that burdensome to me, but you have to make a filing fee and then you can't do the pocket filing like you had hoped. But if you had tried to get it served earlier, a week earlier even, you would have known what your options were.
And with all due respect, Your Honor, service under the policy, under the standard fire insurance policy, service accomplished, whether it's accomplished on the first day after there's damage to the property or whether it's accomplished on the last day, service is still effective. And the only reason that we were not able to accomplish service was the actions that were undertaken by PMA companies. And so looking at whether or not we should have used additional methods, there's a slippery slope there, Your Honor, to say that, you should have attempted personal service. You should have also attempted substitute service. There's a question, should you also have attempted service by publication, if that's a requirement? What we're looking at here is specifically a method of service that is provided for in the Minnesota statutes and Minnesota rules that we attempted to engage in that would have been successful if not for the pandemic, if not for us being unaware that those offices were closed, which again, if we want to go into the principles of equitable estoppel here, there was every opportunity from PMA companies to let us know that those offices would be closed as well. So PMA companies was aware of the complaint as early as August 21st. They were aware of the statutory deadlines and policy deadlines to get that complaint served. And at that time, Your Honor, they chose to conceal whether or not their offices were going to be open. That's knowledge that they specifically had, and we specifically did not.
How were they aware of the complaint on August 21st? I know there was an email exchange about the claim that was made, but I didn't see anything in that email that said, we'll be serving you with a complaint in this matter, or that litigation was anticipated at that point. You know, how did they know a complaint was being prepared on the 21st? And if one was being prepared, then why did it take another 10 days to attempt service?
And Your Honor, that they were aware of the claim. And under the provisions of the policy, once you're aware of the claim, that that policy does provide that any suit not filed within 2 years of the direct damage will result in that suit essentially being dismissed, or that suit not being allowed. And because they are aware of the claim, they should have been aware, Your Honor, of the potential of a lawsuit to enforce Aspenwood's rights in this case. Without that lawsuit, we reached the position we're at here, where again, through your unilateral actions, this Minnesota nonprofit is being denied all of their rights and any decision on the merits simply because they're relying on now this provision of the policy. And just going back to the equitable estoppel argument, again, Aspenwood was completely unaware that those offices would be closed, and Aspenwood did detrimentally rely on the presumption that was made during the contracting period and on the Pennsylvania statute. They relied on the concealment of PMA companies as to whether or not those offices would be open. Again, that's something that PMA companies specifically knew.
I thought the district court found, though, that there was no evidence in the record to support a finding of misrepresentation or concealment. How is that finding how would that be an abuse of discretion by the district court after it's reviewed the record?
And I believe the district court found that there was no evidence of misrepresentation. But what the district court focused on at that point was whether or not there was any inquiry by Aspenwood into whether or not those doors would be open at the time. While Aspenwood didn't make that inquiry, that was knowledge that Aspenwood didn't have that PMA companies did. And so that abuse of discretion would be the failure to look at the evidence and apply those facts to the case, Your Honor. And as far as either of those equitable arguments go, really those stem from what we're looking at here, that under the specific facts of this case, that 2-year time period is unreasonable, Your Honor. And I know that there is a little bit of COVID fatigue at this point, but we have to remember that in August and September of 2020, we were in a time period where doors were being closed by orders, that there was no concrete identical policy across states. And it's specifically for that reason that the Minnesota legislature adopted that House Bill 4556 that did extend any deadlines under the statutes.
Statutory deadlines, not contractual deadlines.
Yes, Your Honor, but this particular contractual deadline is directly taken from the statutory deadline in the Minnesota Standard Fire Insurance Policy.
The Supreme Court in Henning indicates that only applies to fire loss.
And Your Honor, I see that I'm out of time, but if I may answer that question.
You may answer that question.
So what Henning was looking at was specifically a policy provision that separated out limitations periods for different coverages. So that standard fire policy and the fire policy that was at issue in Henning also had, the policy had a different coverage that explicitly changed the limitation period for other types of losses. 10 years after Henning was decided, the Supreme Court in Nath Brothers versus American National Fire Insurance Company did apply the standard fire policy provisions to non-fire losses.
Thank you. You will have 5 minutes for rebuttal if you choose to use it. Counsel for respondent.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court, Chris Goodman for the respondent PMA companies. The district court properly framed the issue, its order, as not whether personal service was possible, which is the thrust of appellant's brief and comments to this court, but whether any type of service was possible within 2 years of the loss. A moment ago, I believe Judge Klopaki, if I'm saying your name correctly, inquired if plaintiff had the option of substitute service within 2 years. Counsel acknowledged they did, but they chose personal service. There's the rub. Of course, the plaintiff, when they retained counsel, had the option of choosing whether to perfect service by sending someone to PMA companies office in Pennsylvania or by substitute service. But when they chose to attempt personal service on the last possible day at 3 something in the afternoon, they ran the risk that service would be ineffective. And the cases, oddly, that are cited in plaintiff's opening brief talk about this assumption of risk concept. We've got in, I believe it's Power v. Siats, S-I-A-T-S, I don't know how to pronounce it. But we've got a delivery driver with a truck full of eggs, chicken eggs, and he knows they're overheated. And the principle from that case is simply that if you know that there's a problem before delivery and you don't take steps to remedy that, the dire consequences of inaction, you don't have an equitable remedy. And that's the problem we have here. They knew the deadline clearly was upon them. They chose to task someone with service in a different state, and it didn't work. Respectfully, COVID didn't change our circumstances. Under Civil Procedure Rule 4.03, a managing agent or officer has to be present to accept service. So let's just assume for the sake of discussion that last August, none of us had to deal with the burdens of COVID. What if the process server shows up after 3 o'clock in the afternoon, and for whatever reason, an authorized agent to accept service isn't there? They'd be in the same situation. COVID didn't change that. So when they choose to proceed by the most risky method, personal service, and it is not successful, that is not fodder for an equitable remedy. The questions, the issues that are raised, counsel has answered several questions about waiver, and I've addressed that in the brief. I'll just deal with the arguments. Is to focus on this concept that it was impractical by burden or expense to go with the route of substitute service. From a simple cost-benefit analysis, we're talking hundreds of dollars to get an action filed in state court. This state works very hard to make sure that every member, every citizen in our state can pursue a legal remedy in court and that it's not cost prohibitive due to filing fees. So I think we can set aside the issue of a financial hardship. In terms of, well, then we'd have to file this affidavit and then there'd be all these litigation expenses. I have at least a half a dozen files with the Smith Jaden firm in which there's a hail claim and they're seeking to recover under a policy. I just had a hearing a month ago with Mr. Whitmer's colleague, Bradley Hammond at Smith Jaden. And the playbook for the Smith Jaden firm, when they're up against a statute and they've timely served, is to immediately move to compel appraisal and stay the litigation. Because under the Quaid versus Secura case from the Minnesota Supreme Court in 2012, when there's a dispute as to the amount of loss, the parties have to go to appraisal before they can have any litigation in court on the issue of coverage. And so if service had been timely perfected, I have no doubt Smith Jaden would have followed their typical modus operandi, moved to stay the proceedings, avoided the expense of which they complain. But my last point on this is simply, that really shouldn't matter here because again, let's weigh the outcomes here. Pay the expense to have someone in Pennsylvania attempt personal service, the route they took, or assume these hardships and burdens that they're complaining of substitute service. Well, however you want to tip the scales, just looking at those from afar, when you then add the fact that the failure to timely serve is fatal to the action, the choice becomes clear. The only reasonable course of action is to print the pleadings, pay the postage for certified mail, and when whatever counsel at Smith Jaden was tasked with this file, they know the day they leave that office that as long as that postage stamped envelope hits the mail, they've preserved their right to commence the action. So considering that service requirements in this state are strictly enforced, there was no abuse of discretion by the district court in noting that not only was substitute service readily available and perfected the day after personal service failed, but there was a choice made here that created the situation. And that defeats the equitable arguments.
So, on that point, Mr. Goodman, we've concentrated on what was or wasn't done or could or couldn't have been done to commence this lawsuit through the commissioner. What about the other side of the equation, that being prejudice to your client in looking at these equitable remedies?
Right. So I think I'll start with equitable tolling and then equitable estoppel, if Your Honor can certainly redirect me if necessary. But equitable tolling, the problem that the plaintiff has with that issue, and we get at it in our brief, is that there have to be no circumstances outside, in this case, the appellant's control that prevented timely service. And clearly the availability of substitute service shreds that argument. Additionally, the case law instructs that we should look at the diligence of the party seeking to take the benefit of equity, again, in this case, the appellant, and we have a lack of diligence between the August 21st notice of the claim and then waiting until 10 days, the last possible day to perfect service. So I think that addresses equitable tolling. With respect to equitable estoppel, Your Honor's question about prejudice, that's one of the factors, but the threshold factor is whether there's a promise or inducement on the part of my client that led the appellant to believe that they would be, for lack of a better word, safe to attempt personal service when they did. And as Judge Hilden found, there was no dialogue, there was no communication prior to the personal service attempt vis-a-vis the appellant and my client, where a representation was made that yes, our office is open, or there'll be someone there to accept service, something to that effect. And so we have the equitable estoppel argument failing on that very first factor. Second factor is reasonable reliance on that representation. Let's just assume there wasn't a representation. The district court says there was not. It wasn't reasonable to assume, that's what happened here, that the office was open in light of the, I believe it was Governor Wolf's executive orders in Pennsylvania saying that all non-essential businesses had to be closed. It was in compliance with that order that the PMA
offices— But Mr. Whitmer seems to argue that your client had an obligation since it, in the contract, said where the office was and where they should be served to notify its policyholders that you're closed because of COVID. How do you respond to that?
Yes, Your Honor, thank you. Two points. The first one would be, I don't believe there's anything in the case law saying that an insurance company has such a burden, but let's just assume it did. That would be impractical for an insurance company to then provide written notice to every policyholder that it has that the office is closed. But I think a better argument, my second point is simply this, Your Honor. COVID did not make the closure of our office a problem because of substitute service. The wisdom, if you will, of the legislature in enacting 45.028 in allowing a Minnesota citizen a very simple and inexpensive means of commencing suit against a foreign insurance company such as my client. COVID made that all the more reason that Aspenwood Condominium should have taken advantage of substitute service. Because if they use substitute service, aside from the minimal expense and the certainty that service will be effective, there's no person-to-person contact. There's no risk that anyone is going to have to interface with anyone at PMA companies during the pandemic and the executive orders in the state of Pennsylvania to preserve their right to pursue this case. And so the concept the plaintiff's talking about, even if we assume it was preserved for appeal, et cetera, COVID made it all the more reasonable and appropriate to do exactly what 45.028 states, which is substitute service by mail on the commissioner. And that's, that I think is the whole crux of the case. That's just the most simplistic and risk-free way of ensuring it. I don't think counsel talked about impossibility, but the case law there, the Zobel v. Dahl case, says that the impossibility of performance, in this case, serving my client, had to have been rendered impossible by something my client did. Again, substitute service meant that regardless of whether COVID was a situation or not, throughout the COVID pandemic, my client has and remains amenable to suit by mailing the pleadings to the commissioner. Again, I think that's why this kind of written notice concept that counsel's raising, where my client had some affirmative duty to communicate to insurers that their office was closed, substitute service made that unnecessary. Again, there was never a barrier to substitute service. And my argument, COVID made substitute service even more prudent under the circumstances. So when we take our same facts and now we apply the legal framework of the doctrine of impossibility, again, my client did not render the concept of timely service impossible because the availability of substitute service existed throughout the COVID pandemic. Regarding this 2020 law, I believe Judge Flory's question hit the nail on the head. The legislature has said that statutory deadlines were extended due to COVID. The statute was not raised to the district court. This is an error correcting court. And so if a district court is not asked to consider or does not consider on its own an issue, it's typically this court of appeals decision to not then entertain that issue on appeal. There is a provision, a narrow set of circumstances where this court will accept review of an issue that wasn't preserved. Counsel doesn't get around to addressing that until the reply brief. But let's just assume, since I have the court's time and attention, that it wants to consider the 2020 law. It extended statutory deadlines. Plaintiffs throughout their briefs acknowledge that the deadline, the suit limitation clause in this case, is contractual in nature. There's no authority cited by the plaintiff that says the legislature intended or even has the authority to abrogate private contractual terms in as broad a manner as they appear to be arguing. And then my last point would be, plaintiff attempts to get around this by bootstrapping the 2020 law to the Minnesota Standard Fire Insurance Policy. Again, Judge Flory, I believe you hit this as well. In the Henning case, I believe from 1986, the Minnesota Supreme Court said that the 65A.01 applies to fire policies. This is not a fire policy. This is not a fire loss. There is a statute that talks about the appraisal process in hail claims. That's 65A.26. Says nothing about the suit limitation period. And remember, under Henning, to say that a suit limitation period is unenforceable requires two things. It's conjunctive. It must conflict with the statute and be unreasonable. We can't even get past the first factor here because the plaintiff hasn't identified any statute that regulates the amount of time that an insured with a non-fire claim has to commence suit. And so Henning and the reasonableness of suit limitation clauses in insurance policies, that isn't an escape hatch for the appellant either.
Appellant cited the Nathy Brothers case on the subject. Do you want to respond to it?
What I heard, Your Honor, was the question was the plaintiff cites to the Nathy Brothers case.
I think that's what appellant recited in response to Judge Flory's question.
Right. 2 points, and these all follow a similar pattern. One, this issue didn't come up at all to the district court and wasn't preserved for this court, but obviously Your Honor's asking about it, so I'll address it. There are circumstances where courts have found that certain suit limitation clauses are not enforceable, but the plaintiff hasn't cited a case that says that a 2-year limitations period is unenforceable, and it certainly wasn't rendered unreasonable in this case, again, because the availability to serve my client by substitute service existed before, during, and throughout the COVID pandemic. And so I hope that answers Your Honor's question. There's just no basis to say that the 2-year limitation period, that a 2-year limitation period is per se unreasonable. And the hook, the first factor under Henning is, if we're going to entertain that issue, if a court is going to question the party's freedom to contract, there has to be a statute conflicting with the limitation period the insurance company specified. There isn't one here. And even if this was a fire loss, the statute requires 2 years, and that's what this policy said. It would conform to that as well. I don't know if my time is up. The screen changed a bit. Barring
your
any questions.
Your time is up if you want to just wrap it up.
To wrap it up, thank the panel for its time. We ask that the court affirm there was no abuse of discretion, and I'll yield. Thank you.
I'm sorry, I was muted. Any rebuttal, Mr. Whitmer? And now you're muted.
I apologize, Your Honor.
Now we can hear, thanks.
First, I'd like to address a couple of the cases that opposing counsel brought up. I believe there's been a misinterpretation here of Henning. Henning provides that an insurance contract can shorten that 6-year, what would ordinarily be the 6-year limitation period for contracts, if the two-part test is satisfied. First, that no specific statute prohibits a shorter limitation, and the time period is reasonable. It's not that that there has to be a statute in place that would provide for a longer limitation. You're looking specifically to here to see if there's a statute that would restrict that shorter limitation. So if that part is satisfied, in this case, we would say that, would agree that there is no statute other than 62A01, the standard fire insurance policy, that provides a shorter limitation. Although again, our argument is that statute limitation time has been extended past 2 years. The next question though is, once you've crossed that burden, that hurdle, is whether or not the time period is reasonable. And so our argument here is that given the state of COVID, that the time period is unreasonable under the facts of this case. And Henning does provide that test is decided on a case-by-case basis. And even if the court did not agree that the Minnesota Standard Fire Policy statute does apply to this case, the reasoning that was the basis of the House's extension of policy deadlines is the same reason that the court should look at here, that COVID-19 at the time was wreaking havoc across the country and making these service issues that the Minnesota House specifically addressed, that was signed into law, was making these service issues things that the legislature decided didn't need to be addressed. So what we're looking at here is again, one day of service after that time period. And given the unreasonableness of that time period during the COVID pandemic, that one day is something that the equitable principles do say should be extended. The tolling argument of equitable tolling that has three factors that the court looks at. First, that the party had no control, and admittedly, the party had no control here. The argument that that Aspenwood assumed any risk, especially looking at Powers v. Seatts, is inaccurate, Your Honors. So Aspenwood, at the time that it attempted service, had no reason to believe that there was a risk of personal service on the insurance company. There was no notification. In Powers versus Seatts, the plaintiff in that case, the company that was carrying the eggs in that case had knowledge that there was an issue. And then even with that knowledge, continued to attempt to make its delivery. There was no knowledge here that's imputed onto Aspenwood that those offices would be closed. I also did want to address briefly opposing counsel's argument regarding the Zobel case. The Zobel case does not support the assertion that the insurance company had to be the reason that there was an impossibility of service here. Instead, Zobel court simply held that generally contract performance is excused when it's hindered or rendered impossible by the other party. Admittedly, the reason that that service may have been impossible here, the reason that the insurance company closed its doors may have been the COVID-19 pandemic. And that's admittedly. The issue we have though is that plaintiff is the one that's bearing the burden of that unilateral decision. And just to close, Your Honor, we're looking here at a situation where plaintiff did everything it could to diligently assess the claim, take actions, protect its rights in attempting that personal service through no fault of its own. And based on the unilateral actions of PMA to shut its doors, that personal service was rendered impossible. Instead of a situation where a Minnesota nonprofit is being allowed the opportunity to pursue its claims on the merits, we have that company being punished for an executive decision here by a foreign insurance company. That result can't be allowed to stand. And for those reasons, we'd ask that this court reverse the district court's ruling and remand the case to proceed on the merits.
Thank you very much. Your briefing and your arguments were helpful, and we will have our opinion out within the 90 days.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you all.
Thank you. And